it's never too late to volunteer. We didn't mention one thing. If you have some couch surfing venue or a room that you could give up, a little coolish sun porch or something like that where you wouldn't mind hosting somebody in from out of town, that's still an availability,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you can sign up to volunteer at the conference, too, and if you have a homestay offer, you can do that on our website.
Right.
It's a big volunteer button.
Yeah, neighbors can be offer hospitality and not actually, I guess that might be any sort of thing, not just offering them your couch for the night. Foreign language translation is even there. So
yeah, in case there are folks who are bilingual in Spanish and English, we have some Spanish speakers coming. So
well, maybe we'll get a Quebecois like I've been hoping for. So, yeah. Cheers. It's time to go. Labor hour is beginning now.
Thanks.
And they're all fired up, I'm sure.
We're not a wagon. folks, welcome to another edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and broadcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are not those of WFT's Board of Management, Prayer Air Incorporated, or anyone except those who express them. So anyway, we're here today. We have host yours truly, David Johnson, co-host Bob Plesney, and co-host and co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorrell. And we're going to have a guest coming in at about half past the hour, a guy named Dan Gilbert, who's going to, he's a labor activist and singer, musician. So in the meantime, we've got some underwriting announcements. Bob?
Thanks, Dave. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month, that's today. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, you can call area code 217-328-2295. That's area code 217-328-2295. And this Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Well, it looks like our Labor Hour poet, Tom Thomas, is not going to be here today, and co-host Pat Simpson is currently over at the Jobs Central Illinois Jobs with Justice meeting, so it'll be the three of us today, plus our guest. So in the meantime, we got some labor news headlines, and I guess we'll start with Bob.
Yeah, Dave, the continuing story that goes on down there in Metropolis, Illinois, about Honeywell. Once again, I get most of this from the great labor reporter Mike Elk and In These Times website. It says, in another sad twist in the long story of worker struggles at the Honeywell Uranium Conversion Plant in Metropolis, Illinois, Honeywell announced Thursday that it will temporarily lay off 228 people, 125 union hourly workers, and 103 non-union salary workers, while it shuts down the plant to perform safety upgrades. A skeleton workforce of 106 employees, union and non-union, will continue working at the plant. The union expects Honeywell to shut down the plant for approximately 12 to 15 months while it makes the upgrades. The shutdown comes after the Nuclear Regulatory Commission found several problems concerning the lack of safety measures in place to prevent the release of toxic UF6 gas in the case of a natural disaster. In the wake of the Fukushima disaster, the NRC is requiring that plants have adequate seismic protection against tornadoes and earthquakes. Currently, the NRC feels that the Metropolis plant is not up to par and has ordered that the plant be shut down until the NRC feels it is safe to be operated. Honeywell takes its commitment to safety seriously, plant manager Larry Smith told the Southern in a statement. We are continuing to discuss the necessary upgrades with the NRC, and we hope to quickly establish a definitive timetable. The layoffs could have a devastating effect on the union, especially since many union members were laid off indefinitely back in May when Honeywell temporarily shut down the plant to investigate claims of sabotage by union workers. While the workers laid off this week retain the right to recall, once the plant reopens, many of them are beginning to look for jobs at other plants, and several have already been successful. If these workers choose not to return to the Honeywell plant when it reopens, the union may ultimately be weakened.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. In fact, that sounds like what their real agenda is, to me, anyway.
Well, yeah, they're going to shut it down for 12 to 15 months. It says here, one of the Honeywell union workers, John Paul Smith, says, it's a win-win for Honeywell. They cut their workforce in half and wait out the free fall of uranium prices. Uranium prices have plummeted 23% since February 2011 when the Fukushima disaster happened.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's wanting to buy that stuff anymore. So Honeywell is kind of cutting its losses here. Mm-hmm. And putting it on the backs of the union again down there.
Yeah, man, I tell you. Okay, in Spain, Spanish workers blocked streets and railroads in Madrid on Friday in protest against new austerity measures they said hurt ordinary people more than the bankers and politicians they blame for the economic crisis, as the Spanish government approved the deepest cuts in 30 years, including a second round of wage cuts and reduced benefits for civil servants. Spain's main unions called on public workers to strike in September. The day the strike will be announced at a later stage, the union said in a statement. Traffic was blocked in central Madrid for hours as hundreds of public workers, many wearing black t-shirts in support of striking miners or green ones for public school teachers, shouted, "Cuts for bankers, not workers," outside ministries and public offices. Workers for state railway Renfe blocked train tracks in Madrid on several occasions throughout the day. Employees of local public TV station Telemadrid blocked a highway outside the city. Several policemen took the unusual step of joining the protesters. Civil servants tolerated the first round of cuts because we wanted to show solidarity, but this has reached a limit, said Pedro, a 41-year-old nurse. It can't always be the same people paying the price. It was the third consecutive day of protests since Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy unveiled fresh austerity measures designed to slash 65 billion euros from the public deficit by 2014 as he tries to dodge a full state bailout after requesting a European rescue for the country's ailing banks in June. Crippled banks, highly indebted regions, and the prospect of a recession continuing beyond 2013 sent Spain's borrowing costs to levels close to unsustainable and pushed the country closer to following Greece, Ireland, and Portugal in seeking external help.
I want to say something, Matt. This is a failure of markets.
Indeed.
And a failure of bond markets and other financing markets for nations.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a failure of miners or a failure of teachers or a failure of construction workers or anybody else.
Well, indeed, and they're trying to balance, you know, basically pay for the bankers' losses, their reckless gambling, if you will, on the backs of working people. You know,
well, and they don't want the bondholders to take a haircut because the bondholders won't buy the bonds again.
Yeah,
you know, that's what I mean. That's where this is a market failure. This market has completely failed all of these nations. This way of doing business has completely failed them. It's completely failed their people.
Mm-hmm.
Bondholders were always secured debtors, right? I mean, if a company went bankrupt, I did work for a company, they went bankrupt, I was like last man on the totem pole to ever get paid, but the bondholders were always number one. They always got paid off first. And any money that came in, the bankruptcy judge always took care of the bondholders first. And you could, you know, they could have owed you $100,000 for work you did for that company and stuff, and you were at the bottom of the totem pole there, basically.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Absolutely so. Ridiculous. Okay, Bob.
Speaking of teachers, Bill, saying it's not about the money, the Chicago teachers inch closer to a strike. The Chicago Teachers Union stepped closer to a strike as it voted Wednesday to reject an arbitrator's recommendations in the contract dispute with Mayor 1% Rahm Emanuel. Though the arbitrator's economic proposals are far more favorable than the city's, CTU leaders say they advise delegates to reject the report. The union's House of Delegates voted it down unanimously. Christine Mayle, CTU financial secretary, says she opposes the report because it fails to take into account the full scope of the union's concerns. It doesn't address the education issues that we're concerned about, she says. Independent arbiter Edwin Benn proposed a 15% raise to match the 20% increase in the school day that Emanuel and the school board want to implement. Benn also called for preserving step increases for years of service and advanced degrees. His recommendations are not binding. Jim Cavallaro, a high school special education teacher and union delegate, stressed that quality of education, issues like smaller classes, computers in the classroom, and nursing and social work services for students matter far more than the money. The school board, none of whose members are elected, also rejected the report's findings today in a closed session. Emanuel slammed the report as not connected to reality, and the school CEO said raises for teachers would necessitate layoffs and cutbacks. Scheduled bargaining sessions will continue as planned, but since both the board and the union have rejected the report, the Chicago Teachers Union is now free to strike after 30 days.
Well, I tell you, it's been a real mess up there in Chicago for a while now. I mean, with their attempts basically to try to use public tax dollars to start private charter schools. And I'm telling you, the teachers union up there has been in a heck of a fight. And, of course, people suffering besides the teachers, of course, are the students and the parents and the community in general. But anyway, it seems like we got a picketer that walked into the labor hour here. Says, people first, U of I fire Sayworth Shaw.
Yeah, but Arne Duncan fails upward like so many corporate people. Yeah, the turnaround artist who was in charge of the Chicago school system, right now he's Secretary of Ed, and all he did was, his only credential is his mother was a teacher.
Oh, he played basketball.
Oh, well, that's a credential. Yeah.
Anyway,
he was taught by teachers.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that's true.
But he wants them all to be corporate, and I heard him. Oh, anyway, I attended the Thursday rally. Fair treatment for all workers. It was a combination of all of the unions on the U of I campus, basically. Steel workers are in for some kind of session.
Oh, okay.
So we were filled in the ranks with some radical steel workers, actually.
It's always great when those guys come to town every year.
Yeah. So, but I made up my own sign, and what I have here is People First, which was a slogan that our Governor Quinn circulated. In fact, this was one that I got through his campaign, and I'm trying to bring him back to his earlier motto.
Uh-huh.
But the Seaford Shaw reference is the fact that the U of I doesn't want to rely on its own negotiators to be as badass as they want, apparently, so mm-hmm. they hire one of the premier union-busting law firms, Seaford Shaw. Mm. Our friend Gene Vanderport says whenever they get involved, everything goes to crap.
Indeed. So, in fact, former mayor of Urbana, Todd Sarathway, hired Seaford Shaw through his city manager against the Urbana Fire Department back quite a few years ago.
Is that when they were taking down that extra fire station and that whole
yes.
thing, integrating it?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. That's I guess that's one of the things I'll hold against the former mayor.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, U of I reportedly spent $3 million on this firm.
Mm-hmm.
$30 million would be enough to pass through the raises that were sort of authorized by the legislature
mm-hmm.
Some time ago. So they're spending 10% of the money fighting the unions, and union busting is disgusting.
Indeed.
Slogan from the campus. Thanks for letting me report back from the. It was a pretty good big show. Everybody was kind of huddled in shady areas,
uh-huh.
But they marched around on the quad even as I was leaving. So
oh great,
I don't know. Good. Probably didn't see any coverage on any of the local corporate outlets either.
Oh, surprise, surprise. Yeah. And what day was this again?
This was just Thursday.
Yeah. Thursday, okay.
Yeah.
Ricky
Baldwin's got some stuff up on the SEIU or his Facebook page. Hmm. Got some pictures up too, I think.
Yes, in fact, Ricky Baldwin and Gene Vanderport are going to be coming in to next week's show. And,
cheers.
So I'm sure they'll have a lot to talk about, including this.
Well, if I chill out enough, I'm going to make it to the Socialist Forum meeting today, which is happening 12:30 at the Bread Company too. So.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay, this is...
Oh, wait a minute.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
I just wanted to highlight what he just said, that there's a Socialist Forum meeting at the... Where is it?
The Bread Company on Goodwin, next to Canopy Club.
Okay. I just want people to hear that.
Okay. All right. We got this story came off the factsforworkingpeople.org site. Here we go again with a political struggle over corporate and union donations to political causes. There have been numerous attempts to pass laws against such donations. Both unions and corporations are included in an attempt to obscure the real intention, which is to curb organized labor's participation in the political process. The issue is Proposition 32, which is intended to ban both corporate and unions' contributions to candidates. The union hierarchy opposes the measure, claiming that loopholes for businesses exist while union funds will be shut down, and it has committed over $8 million so far to fight it, much more than the supporters. The League of Women Voters is also opposed to Proposition 32 because quoting their spokesman, it says, because it doesn't affect both sides equally, says Helen Hutchinson. The union hierarchy pretty much takes the same approach. The legislation is unfair. Loopholes will be found by the corporations, et cetera, et cetera. And the supporters of the proposition trying to claim that this is going to curb all special interest monies, a sort of curse on both your houses, are trying to hide the real purpose of an attack on labor by tapping into the disgust Americans have with our political system, dominated as it is by money, the 1%, and their two political parties. Okay, Bob?
Story out of New York. Consolidated Edison in New York has reinstated health insurance for 8,500 locked-out New York utility workers. As the lockout is about to enter its fourth week here, The Con Ed workers were locked out on June 30th after their contract expired and negotiations over a new one failed. It says about 5,000 managers are keeping electricity going for 3.2 million customers in New York City and Westchester County. Neither Con Ed nor the union has indicated any real progress. Con Ed spokesman said last Sunday that negotiations with the Utility Workers Union of America, Local 1-2, were set to resume on Monday. Union spokesman John Malia said the company bowed to public pressure in reinstating the health insurance, and workers were going to be covered for July retroactively. Consolidated Edison is defending the way it has handled the lockout of more than 8,000 workers to a state regulator. In a filing to the State Public Service Commission, the utility said it had no choice but to lock out the workers after the union said it would not give 72 hours notice before striking so the utility could provide its customers uninterrupted service as contract talks expired. Quoting a Con Ed statement here, it says, "If the union leadership directed our union employees to leave their jobs without warning, we would have understaffed energy control centers and substations." The filing is in response to a request by Local 1-2, the Utility Workers of America, that the PSC force the utility to end the lockout. The utility has about 5,000 managers handling service, maintenance, and emergency operations, usually handled by the members of Local 1-2. It says, meanwhile, union workers from across the city rallied outside Con Ed's headquarters at Irving Place and supported the locked-out workers, and then marched to Union Square in the midst of another heat wave blanketing the city. Transit employees, teachers, and steam fitters chanted, "We are one," and vowed to support the workers until they received a fair contract. But what many people are finding extraordinary was the company's disclosure that in order to replace the locked-out union employees, 8,500, they mobilized 5,000 managers, you know. Says maybe this is a case of too many chiefs and not enough Indians. You know, if you got 5,000 managers for a company and you only got 8,500 workers there at that company.
Wow.
Makes you wonder. They said maybe that's one of the reasons why Con Ed is sky-high rates and frequent rate increases.
Yeah, that could definitely be one of those reasons for sure.
Yes.
Unless they got a lot of, misclassified employees to get out, to make, put them on salary and, you know, that game, you know.
Yep.
But anyway, I finally got one thing here. It's actually an obituary by Jeffrey St. Clair. It's in regards to Alexander Coburn, political writer who was born 1941 and died here just recently. It goes to say, our friend and comrade Alexander Coburn died two nights ago in Germany after a fierce two-year-long battle against cancer. Alex kept his illness a tightly guarded secret. Only a handful of people knew how terribly sick he was. And he didn't want his friends and readers to shower him with sympathy. He didn't want to blog his own death as Christopher Hitchens had done. Alex wanted to keep living his life right to the end. He wanted to live on his terms, and he wanted to continue writing through it all, just as his brilliant father, the novelist and journalist Claude Coburn did. Even though his body was deteriorating, his prose remained as sharp, lucid, and deadly as ever. In one of Alex's last emails to me, he patted himself on the back, and deservedly so, for having only missed one column through his increasingly, debilitating and painful last few months. Amid the chemo and blood transfusions and painkillers, Alex turned out not only columns for Counterpunch, The Nation, and First Post, but he also wrote a small book called Guillotine and finished his memoirs called A Colossal Wreck, both of which Counterpunch plans to publish over the course of the next year. It says Alex lived a huge life, and he lived it his way. He hated compromise in politics, and he didn't tolerate in his own life. He leaves a huge void in our lives, and he taught at least two generations how to think of how to look at the world and how to live a life of resistance. So the struggle continues, and we're going to remain engaged, and he wouldn't have it any other way. And we have a comment on this from local TV personality Carl Esterbrook. He writes, what terrible news for all of us. It was just over 2 years ago that Alexander Coburn was here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk for an Illinois peace group. And we interviewed him on News from Neptune and ate at various places around town. And he says, as it happens, I was thinking and writing about my introduction to him this week when I was answering a half-mad attack on Coburn's recent Occupy piece by a local person. And I was just recalling first reading him in the Village Voice 40 years ago. So Anyway, Bill, you said Paul Muth in the previous show talked a little bit about Coburn, or
yeah, he described a presentation by Coburn and an appearance, and said that Coburn refused to recycle his newspapers because he didn't want to give. I think it was Weyerhaeuser, you know, one of the major mm-hmm. paper companies. He didn't want to contribute to their bottom line. And I don't know, perhaps this was pre-internet or something, uh-huh. but I was kind of thinking, well, maybe you shouldn't buy the newspaper in the first place because that contributes originally. But Alexander Coburn was, I read him quite a bit. Well, not so much lately, but back when I used to read The Nation all the time. And much like his often opponent, Christopher Hitchens, you know, took some controversial positions that a lot of people didn't consider very left wing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Coburn. Usually, I agree with his articles, but there were some he did read. I mean, wrote that I was totally opposed to.
Well,
know,
yeah, opinion. Hitchens and his support of the wars, and Alexander Coburn being a global warming, or at least a human-produced global warming denier, mm-hmm. who is famous for having giant old gas-guzzling Cadillacs and such. Mm-hmm. I can't remember a specific mm-hmm. car, but I remember. So,
yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But well, he was definitely an interesting read, no matter
yes,
what.
Yes, indeed. Okay, we're going to go to a little Jim Hightower here, and then we'll be right back, so stay tuned.
Forget the Dow Jones. The real measure of our economy is the Doug Jones average. Hear about it today on Hightower Radio. To measure how our economy is doing, media outlets keep a constant eye on the Dow Jones average. But they're like cats watching the wrong mouse hole. For the great majority of Americans have between zero and next to nothing in the stock market. The economic measure that matters most to most folks is the Doug Jones average. The Doug is concerned about such key indicators as the pump price on a gallon of regular, the subprime value of today's 7.25 minimum wage, and the impact of global inflationary pressures on the cost of a six-pack. So, how are Doug and Dottie Jones doing? The number crunchers at the Federal Reserve have just answered that for us. Not well. Not well at all. In its latest survey of consumer finances, the Fed found that from 2007 to 2010, all but the wealthiest 10% of American households have been downwardly mobile. The median net worth of U.S. households tumbled in those 4 years by a startling 39%, falling to the lowest level in 20 years. In short, Americans are not merely feeling poorer, they are. Foreclosures, lost jobs, wage declines, and other reductions, combined with rising costs of everything from gasoline to child care, have become the norm, shoving many proud middle-classers into poverty. Yet, Washington remains fixated on the Dow Jones average and the stock market elite, with Republican leaders even clamoring for a return to the disastrous policies of trickle-down economics that caused this decline. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, 3/4 of Americans today have more invested in their aging cars than in stocks. With the consumer economy busted, America's cars are now, on average, 11 years old. Restoring American prosperity begins with restoring the Joneses to the middle class. It's percolate up economics that we need, not tinkle down.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Okay, that was Jim Hightower, and just have one public service announcement here for you. Tomorrow, on Sunday, from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 or Band of Public Television, you can check out Labor's Worldview. That's on every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6. And tomorrow is going to be a video semi-documentary of my recent trip to Cuba in June. So check it out. And also, in addition to the film that's going to be shown tomorrow from 4 to 5, we are going to be posting a YouTube video of it that you'll be able to access through Urbana Public Television's website. And if you want to read a little bit after seeing the video about some more detail of my trip there in June, you can go to facts, FaxForWorkingPeople.org. That's FaxForWorkingPeople.org. And we're going to play a little bit of Dan Gilbert here, and then we're going to be right back with Dan Gilbert himself. So stay tuned. Okay, that was Dan Gilbert off his CD, and that was One Break Away. And we're honored to have Dan Gilbert himself here live in the studio. Dan, welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, tell us a little about yourself.
Well, I teach here in Urbana at the U of I's Labor Education Program. So that's a big part of my life these days, and I just heard you guys talking a little while ago about the great rally we had on campus, I guess on Thursday, and all the steelworkers who were in town taking part in that rally. And that's one of the best parts of my life these days, is getting the opportunity to teach union members, and we've got steelworkers in town all summer. But before I got to this part of the world, I grew up in Rhode Island, mm-hmm. On the East Coast, and the great city of Providence.
Okay.
I'm a historian. I study U.S. cultural history, U.S. labor history. And when I'm not teaching, I like to write songs and play guitar.
So you're from the hometown of the former, now I think president emeritus of the Laborers Union, Arthur Coya.
Is that right?
I didn't know. Yes, he was from Providence, Rhode Island.
Kidding. Wow, another reason to celebrate the the great city of Providence.
Well, maybe. Maybe. Yes. But Peter Miller, he's in New Hampshire. He's not in Rhode Island. Okay, yeah, one of the co-founders of the show, moved out towards your original area of the country and everything. So you teach at the Labor Institute, and so how long have you been a musician?
Well, I was really lucky growing up. I remember my mother taking me to an instrument store when I was probably 6 or 7 years old and said, Dan, you can pick out an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar was both shiny and beautiful and also something that I could make a sound on without knowing anything about it other than, say, a clarinet or a violin or something.
Uh-huh.
I actually have to know something. And so I was really lucky. I got to start taking guitar lessons as a little kid. And my parents were, children of the 60s and always had folk music playing in the house. And so I kind of got into playing folk music. And then when I was older, I was in rock bands and jazz bands in college and been playing pretty much my whole life.
Okay. Well, I suppose you want to do a song for us. What song do you want to do?
Sure. Well, I was thinking, we just celebrated Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought maybe I'd play one of my favorite songs that he sang, which is This Train is Bound for Glory.
Okay.
All right. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory, don't ride nothing but righteous and bold. This train is bound for glory. This train won't carry no jokers. This train won't carry no jokers. This train won't carry no jokers. Neither don't carry no cigar smokers. This train bound for gold. This train is built for speed.
Okay, all right. So tell me, do you ever pull out your guitar in any of your classes at any point, like towards the end of the semester or something?
Yeah,
Do you really? Okay.
Actually, just yesterday we had the graduation ceremony for some steel workers who just completed their fourth summer session, and so at the graduation ceremony yesterday they let me sing a little bit, which was really fun.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Now I know the steel workers come to town every year about this time. Can you tell me a little bit about what that program is?
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. Ever since right after World War II, I think 47 was the first of these summer institutes with the steel workers, and the summer schools began in that moment in labor history, where for the first time we start to see big collective bargaining agreements across basic industries in the U.S. and And so there are all kinds of questions about, you know, how does collective bargaining work? How do, you know, how do workers and employers sit down together and work out their differences? And over the years, you know, it's been running ever since. And so over the years, the classes have focused on, continue to focus on some of those nuts and bolts issues, but have you know, at various moments looked at de-skilling and, you know, mechanization and outsourcing and globalization. This summer, we had a lot of folks in town from Indiana. This summer school is in the Steelworkers District 7, which covers Illinois and Indiana. So a lot of our brothers and sisters to the east are facing the new reality of right to work and are trying to figure out how to organize in a different context and how to keep folks members of the union and building the union going forward. So it's really a remarkable school every summer with the steelworkers. We've got Ask Me members coming in a few weeks for a similar deal. But actually, on this past Sunday night, the president of the Illinois of the University of Illinois, Robert Easter, actually came in and greeted the steelworkers.
Did he really?
He said, "Welcome to campus."
Uh huh.
Extension teaching and meeting the educational interests and needs of working people in the state and in this region is core to the mission of the U of I. And so we were really pleased to hear that from the new president and hope that maybe some of that enthusiasm and support for working people will spill out into the bargaining table as well.
Well, I was wondering, is there anything like this or any participation in this program or anything like this for local unions, or do they participate in this kind of a program or this particular one at all?
Yeah, and it's a great question. Thank you for asking. We the labor education program at the U of I exists to serve the educational interests and needs of union members and other workers throughout the region, throughout the state. So, you know, during the summer, we spend a lot of time in these kind of annual schools, but throughout the year, we teach classes for locals, for central labor bodies, for groups of interested workers and community members around any number of issues, and we are actively seeking, you know, new ideas for classes, and we'd love to hear from folks out there listening about classes that you might like to take, whether through your locals or just as you know, interested folks in the community. So you can look us up online. You can send me an email at gilbertd@illinois.edu, and I'd love to be in touch about that stuff. Thanks for asking that question.
Okay. You know, one thing I noticed at the Labor Institute was there's a plaque out in the front entrance that I guess the steel workers actually lent the, part of the money to build the institute back way back in the late 40s.
Yeah, it's you know, it's part of the really cool history of the school. The School of Labor and Employment Relations, which used to be the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations, was founded in part because the state labor movement fought for a piece of legislation in Springfield right after World War II. And so we've been around since then in large part because of the power and support of the labor movement, and the building that we're in, which I think was built around 1960, was built with the support and the hard-earned dollars in part of steelworkers and other union members, and so we're extraordinarily proud of that history.
That's good. Well, I'm really glad to hear that there's still a good labor presence at the school, because I've been to a lot of events there and classes over the years, and man, it just seems like in that main meeting area you see all these corporate plaques and very few from unions, you know.
Yeah, it's something that that we need to do a better job of publicizing, I think, and finding new ways to reach out to folks as we've lost, you know, as the labor movement has moved from representing, you know, over a third of working people in this country in the 50s to the kind of really gloomy numbers where we are now. The field of industrial relations has reflected that, and but we've got six full-time faculty members who are labor studies professors who are committed to teaching workers and folks interested in labor history and other topics, and so we want to erect some new plaques maybe in that in that central hall too.
Yeah, I kind of noticed around universities that some things occur because of kind of the cultural zeitgeist of a certain time, and they're kind of kept, I mean, but they keep on going. Such as if you walk around the university, you will look up and you'll see some building that was built 100 years ago, and it'll say learning and labor.
Right.
I'm working at Gregory Hall recently, and I'm looking across at Lincoln Hall, and I'm seeing these just fantastic quotes from Abraham Lincoln. And I just really, I'm really glad that that happens. For example, you have rhetoric here, and basically it's composition. Whereas at Illinois State, rhetoric is a different thing, but that's because the University of Illinois started teaching that sometime around the turn of the 20th century. Huh. And I just really hope we can keep these things going and use them to create a new zeitgeist. Yeah. Because I can remember up until the 1970s how the working class in the United States was really extolled. It was a major part of our culture, jokes continuously about how janitors and buildings made more than the white collar people they were cleaning up after, and so on and so forth. In the 1970s, truck driver hero movies, yeah. And I think that's what really counts, and that's what's really good about with music. And I noticed you had some provocative titles on your CD there, but I don't have. Such as The Great Recession Goodbye, Afghanistan. And I think if you also look at, like, say, the 1960s, a role that musicians and other artists played in promoting that sort of slightly different set of values that was more identity-based rather than class-based.
Right.
And that song you did by Woody Guthrie, I mean, it's such a wonderful metaphor about the train and the writers on it. And keep it up.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
How long has your CD been out, Dan?
Well, I did it, I guess it's been out just about a year.
Okay.
I had the opportunity to make this record. I was living up in Minnesota for the last few years and worked with some musicians up there to do this thing.
Okay. What part of Minnesota?
St. Paul.
Okay.
Great city of St.
Paul. Never been there, but I heard a lot of great things about Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Twin Cities are a great part of the world and really a great union, union town.
Yeah, I know there's a pretty strong and large Industrial Workers of the World chapter up there. They had a big campaign against Jimmy John's, which went nationwide, so to speak. It's got a great history and it's continuing on. It's a fairly strong union area to this day, it seems.
Yeah, I remember reading many references over the years to the Mesabi Range, a big mining area. Mining was really such a contested industry all over the world to this day.
Absolutely, and the taconite story continues up on Superior.
And let's not forget the 1934 general strike in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Yeah. But let's get back to some of your music. What would you like to do next?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll play The Great Recession Goodbye.
Okay.
That's okay.
That sounds great.
Topical.
I've been working like a dog, part-time wages at a full-time job. Caught the boss on the line today. Before I knew it, goodbye. I don't need you. Goodbye. Never felt sweeter. I'll hit my stride before I hit St. Peter later on tonight. I've been living work in an old charcoal grill. Goodbye. I don't need you. Goodbye. Never felt sweeter. I'll hit my stride before I hit St. Peter later on tonight. I've been dealing with a governor, acting like the unions were the ones who broke the world. I walked out in the street today with a million honest people, and man, we sent him on his way. We said goodbye. I don't need you. Goodbye. Never felt sweeter. I'll hit my stride before I hit St. Peter later on tonight. I've been talking with some friends of mine, stirring up some trouble, starting to organize. Made a plan to hit the road, maybe build something new from these ashes of the old. Goodbye. I don't need you. Goodbye. Never felt sweeter. I'll hit my stride before I hit St. Peter later on tonight. I've been driving this old Chevrolet long enough to know a couple stops along the way. I'll put St. Paul in my rear view roll down the window, sing out through my tears. Goodbye. I don't need you. Goodbye. Never felt sweeter. I'll hit my stride before I hit St. Peter later on tonight.
All right, great. Thank you. Well, I tell you, a lot of workers can relate to that song. It's a sign of the times for sure. Is there anything in particular that motivated you to write that song, other than just the general conditions out there?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think it's a combination of looking around and seeing all the effects and impacts and struggles of the last few years, you know, in particular since 2008, and, you know, the ways in which, you know, we had this big debate in Washington over compensation bonuses for Wall Street execs, while, you know, we can't seem to figure out how to keep people in their homes. And so, you know, a lot of these big stories that I felt like either were getting told and they were pissing me off, or weren't getting told and that was pissed. And then and some, just, you know, going through the job I was working as a teacher up in Minnesota. It was part time, and I was trying to get full time work as a teacher and as an academic, and you know, wanting to say goodbye to some of those personal struggles that I was having.
You know, that's a I had a film class at the Labor Institute a couple years ago, taught by Professor Joe Berry, who's since moved to Berkeley, right. And very fascinating class. In fact, he had a film about the battle of adjunct professors to try to get full-time positions with benefits, and it's like, you know, it was amazing. I had no idea it was that bad in academia. The majority of the people that teach classes, I mean, this one person, man, he looked like he was in his like early 60s, and he still hadn't gotten any kind of full-time position for 30-40 years. And what was interesting about the film, it started out by showing kind of the background of that film, Harvest of Shame, where all the you know, the people are lining up to get on the trucks to go pick the harvest. And it's like, man, what a eerie parallel to actually academia.
And indeed, many folks teaching college classes are really migrating between multiple universities every semester, you know, folks to just to make really a living wage, often without benefits, are cobbling together, you know, 5-6 classes at 2 or 3 different colleges. Joe Barry's great book on adjunct labor is really one of the great books out there, not only about contemporary universities but about the contemporary labor movement.
Well, Joe couldn't get a full time gig here.
That's right.
You know, as he's gone, no more.
But he continues to write and organize. I know he's about to be down in Mexico City with a really kind of extraordinary transnational meeting of part time and adjunct.
Oh, really?
Workers.
Oh,
yeah.
That sounds fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen. We've got about 7 minutes left in the program, and I'd love to, if it's okay with you, get one more song in, and then we'll kind of finish out. Maybe give people, your email address or website where they could maybe get a copy of the CD if you'd like.
Terrific.
So, what would you like to play for us now?
Maybe I'll do. I think my mother may be listening.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to do the song that she told me that she likes the best off the record.
Okay, absolutely.
I'll Get Along.
Okay.
Some houses had their stories behind pictures on the wall. Some places had become ghost towns before their shadows ever fall. Old words lose their meaning on their way to the past. These echoes still find me here, each one louder than the last. Every year I live without you, every tear that I cry about you, every fear, every little doubt that you bury in my heart. They might run and overtake me. They might hold me up and shake me. They might bend. I'll get along. Maybe some of us ain't lucky. Maybe some just don't fit right. Some kinds of loving to last for a while. Let the silence settle over.